It's my pleasure to introduce the first keynote speaker today, Professor Ronald Sultana. Professor Sultana is a well-known academic in the Mediterranean research field. He has contributed immensely to this area through his research network, and particularly because he pioneered the only journal of Mediterranean studies in education that we know of, which is the Mediterranean Journal of Educational Studies, which is now in its 12th volume, 14th volume? 13th volume. Ronald and I go back a number of years. We were employed at the faculty together in 1988. He on a full-time basis, I was on a part-time basis at the time. And we collaborate in the area of sociology of education. And he'll be talking about looking back on 15 years of comparative educational research in the Mediterranean.
Thank you very much, Peter. And also thanks to Carmel for inviting me to address you. They have been excellent organizers, both in terms of the scientific content of the program and also in terms of the logistics. They even organized the weather for us to make sure that you come to this address, but I know that they have organized some sunshine as soon as the conference finishes, so this is excellent. So without further ado, I'll start my address. As the speaker presenting the first keynote of this conference, I feel it appropriate to provide a context for the challenge that we are addressing, namely that of doing comparative education in the Mediterranean. I want to do so in a particularly personal and narrational manner, drawing on qualitative studies I have carried out in the region, as well as the structured attempt through our Euro-Mediterranean Center for Educational Research to develop Mediterranean comparative studies as a generative endeavor. In so doing, I also want to introduce those of you who are visiting us for the first time to aspects of Malta's culture and history, which, as you will see, are what made me who I am, and have also had a decisive impact on my approach to scholarly work in our region. This attempt to link culture, identity, and scholarship seems to me the best way to not only address this emergent field of Mediterranean comparative education, but also to link it to the specific theme of the conference, namely intercultural dialogue through education. What I hope to do, therefore, is to draw on my personal experiences over the last 15 years as a comparativist, highlighting the academic as well as the personal and cultural identity challenges that this endeavor represented to me, with a view to identifying three key obstacles that I see ahead of us in this regional venture, while outlining some agendas for the future. I trust that in tackling this ambitious task that I have set myself, I will not prove right that caustic commentator who defined conferences as the confusion of one man multiplied by the number of participants present. My experiences as an educational researcher in the region are of two kinds. The first set of experiences that I would like to refer to consists of the qualitative studies that I have carried out over the past decade. My research has taken me to Albania, Egypt, Syria, Tunisia, Turkey, Palestine, and to a more limited extent to Lebanon, Morocco, and Jordan. Some of these studies have a single country focus. Others, like the recent study of career guidance across 10 countries and territories in the MEDA region, are comparative in scope. Most involved writing case studies of educational innovation, which serve partly as evaluations and partly as testimonies to educational success stories in the region. As I have argued elsewhere, we need these stories of success, not least as a way of writing back to the international community that has tended to see educational development in the region almost exclusively in deficit terms. In my work, I have written about efforts to integrate low-achieving students in state schools across the poorest regions in Albania. I have documented how girl-friendly community schools are managing to overcome traditional prejudice in remote rural areas, in several governorates in Egypt, where Muslim and Coptic parents now agree to to keep their daughters in education rather than marrying them off on the onset of puberty. In another study, I have described how some brave teachers and schools in Syria have dared to go against the grain, adopting critical pedagogies in order to ensure that their students experience and develop a taste for democracy. In Tunisia, I have tried to capture the rise of mastery learning as a movement to guarantee access for all children to a minimum standard of education, even when they live in the remotest villages on the borders with Algeria, in the desert-like environment in Kef and Katrin. In a comparative study I have recently carried out, I looked closely at education policy implementation process in Albania, Kosovo and Turkey in an attempt to understand how reforms change schools, or should I say, how schools change reforms. The place I have visited most remains Palestine, a country that I always go to with hope, but from which I increasingly depart with a heavy heart, if not despair, as I see people fenced in, communities fragmented, and human rights trampled underfoot with impunity. In Palestine, I documented the setting up of a most impressive education management information system meant to support the efficient implementation of an ambitious and sound educational plan, as well as a new national curriculum. Not an easy task in one of the few territories in the world where communities live in areas that are not contiguous to each other. In another study, I tried to capture the ingenuity of the Palestinian people in Hebron in their effort to ensure that their children retained access to education despite the curfews, attacks on schools, and mobility restrictions imposed by Israeli forces after the Second Intifada. The Hebronites' use of basic education methods, of distance education methods, has proved inspirational to other societies in conflict, where schools and teachers are among the first to bear the brunt of aggression. More recently, and in response to an invitation by UNESCO and UNRWA, I have met with students, teachers and parents in refugee camps in the West Bank, in Jordan and in Lebanon, including those living in the infamous Sabra and Shatila camps, in order to evaluate the quality of education that is available to Palestinians born in exile. All of these studies have involved fieldwork, school and classroom observations, interviews with policymakers, teachers, students, parents, and other educators. All have had an especially formative influence on me, shaping my perceptions of the educational challenges in the region, as well as of the resources that the region has in meeting such challenges. I will return to these studies at a later stage in my presentation with a view to highlighting some of the lessons that can be distilled from them with comparative education in mind. The second set of professional experiences that connect me to the Mediterranean revolve around the setting up of a comparative education program at the University of Malta 15 years ago. The story behind the setting up of this program, which has now matured into a modest research center, is relevant to this conference for more than one reason. It must be immediately said that the initial motivation behind establishing the program were less than pure. The University of Malta, as indeed the rest of the island, had made a strategic decision in the mid-80s to implement the hub concept in an effort to use its position in the middle of the Mediterranean to provide goods and services to surrounding countries. This hub concept was applied to several sectors of the economy, leading to the setting up of a free port, the building up of a new international airport, and the rapid development of financial and even offshore services. The concept was also to be implemented in the higher education sector, with universities set to expand and to attract fee-paying students from surrounding countries, having as a major advantage the use of English as the language of instruction. Academics were encouraged to focus on Mediterranean studies or to introduce a Mediterranean dimension in their teaching and research. This also fed into a widespread fantasy that the Maltese have of themselves, namely that puny, I would say racist Malta, can act as a bridge between North Africa and Europe, when in fact our history shows that what we have done best is to act as a bulwark to keep non-Europeans, whatever these are, and Islam, out of Europe, a vocation that, might I add, we ironically seem to have revived with a vengeance when, following our entry into the EU in 2004, we became a vital outpost in helping the EU secure its borders through collaborating with Frontex operations. In this way, the Mediterranean Sea, which, as Professor Creso so correctly pointed out, for centuries has acted as the main vehicle of communication between the basins north and south, east and west, is now traversed by an invisible but no less effective replica of the Berlin Wall, infused by the Schengen spirit, which strives to keep the frontiers of fortress Europe intact and the boat people at bay. This university-driven Mediterranean agenda coincided with other aspects of my personal history as an academic. My ego, because apparently I have one, has taken several blows at conferences where few, if any, ever turned up to listen to papers I had prepared on educational issues related specifically to Malta. Few, if any, felt that what happened in a country barely larger than a middle-sized European town with a population of less than 400,000 had any relevance to them or their work. The new research agenda proposed by the university, therefore, promised to expand my horizons from a too narrow focus on Malta towards a wider embracing comparative gaze at the rest of the region, with the hope, therefore, of becoming somebody at the university and somebody at international conferences and the academic stage more generally. I embarked on this Mediterranean Odyssean voyage, little knowing where it would lead to. Initial efforts were promising. I recall being encouraged by the likes of the Sicilian Giovanna Pampanini, who we met yesterday, who had already been fighting windmills, so to speak, in his quixotic efforts to stimulate interest in a Mediterranean comparative dimension. Together with the support of colleagues from the Faculty of Education and some seed funding from UNESCO, we established an extensive network of educational researchers from all over the region, creating a database that profiled their academic background and expertise with a view to facilitating collaborative projects. Different members of this network met annually at small, intimate conferences in Malta, Florence, Cyprus, and elsewhere, where we focused on such issues as educational innovation, teacher education, science education, power and education, higher education, each bringing the experiences of his or her own country and sharing them in intensive debating sessions that increased our knowledge of each other and provided us with new opportunities for understanding how our respective education systems were marked, for instance, by shared Mediterranean colonial and post- or neo-colonial histories, by the nature of the relations between the state, religious power, and formal schooling, by cultural traditions that shaped gender boundaries and life chances in particular ways, and so on. Different members of the same network also supported the launch of an international journal with a regional focus, the Mediterranean Journal of Educational Studies, copies of which are in your pack. Now, in its 13th year of publication, the journal, produced, I might add proudly, in cottage industry style, appears twice annually, and with 24 issues behind it, has established itself as a unique venue for scholarship reporting on educational issues in the Mediterranean, and serving subscribers from as far afield as Australia, Russia, the US, China, and Japan, not to mention most of Europe, the Middle East, and to a lesser extent, North Africa. We are hoping to reach out to more academic communities by turning it into an open access journal online, particularly as we notice that those who we most want to engage in our region are the ones with the least resources to subscribe, despite the advantageous fee structures we have put into place for low-income countries. This very productive interaction between like-minded scholars from the region, together with the knowledge resources that we have accumulated in our center, led to the launch of a master's degree focusing on comparative education in the Mediterranean. To our knowledge, the first master's of its kind now being offered to a second cohort of students. We hope to build on this experience in order to open it up to students from all over the region, particularly if we manage to secure sponsorships and scholarships from the sources we are tapping. I cannot stress how pivotal and compelling both these sets of overlapping experiences, that is, both the qualitative research I carried out in the region and the setting up of a Mediterranean Comparative Education Research Center, have been for me academically and personally. Let me focus first a little on the impact they have had on my academic work, and particularly on my understanding of educational issues. Prior to the start of this Mediterranean journey, I had been happily looking at educational phenomena in Malta through the theoretical and conceptual lenses provided by mainstream metropole scholars, particularly Anglo-Saxon ones, and to a lesser extent continental ones, such as Bourdieu or Habermas, even though, often though, through translations or commentaries in English. Needless to say, these remain giants on whose shoulders we need to climb. Nevertheless, my qualitative research in the region soon made it clear to me that the context from which metropole frameworks arose differed from those that we are embedded in the economic and geographic South. The comparative work I was doing with colleagues pointed out the need for developing a greater sensitivity to the fact that the economic, cultural, political, and social dynamics in the so-called periphery and semi-periphery have their own specificity and require more context-sensitive theoretical tools in order to carry out the Freirean task of reading or decoding our world. Some of the colleagues engaged in this effort to develop theoretical understandings of educational issues in the Mediterranean have been particularly successful in working both with and against mainstream sociological frameworks, developing sophisticated and nuanced understanding of educational issues. The Catalan Javier Bonal, for example, the Palestinian Andre Mazraoui, as well as Linda Herrera and my colleague Peter Meo, all of whom have served generously on the editorial board of our journal, have written some excellent sociological papers on a variety of aspects of education in the Mediterranean, and are in a way exceptional in that their work has attained visibility in both North and South. But there is much out there, in education as in other disciplines, that is written in ways that connect in an especially profound and visceral way with our realities, even if these writings predictably fail to capture the attention of metropole publishers and their public. Earlier, I said that the experience of developing a Mediterranean comparative education dimension has had an impact on me both academically and personally. I have dealt a little with the former, and about that even more later. I must, however, dwell a little on the impact all this has had on my sense of who I am. The conference focus is, after all, on intercultural dialogue. And what is culture? But the cultivation of a sense of self within broadening circles of overlapping communities. This word intercultural, like its relative term cross-cultural, is a bit tricky. It tends to project an image of essentialized and stable entities, rarefied national cultures that, at the best of times, are prepared to converse with each other. This is a potentially dangerous conception, which plays into the same ideological terrain of that powerful myth that has captured our imaginary, namely the infamous clash of civilizations. Cultures, to my mind, are complex historical mongrels whose very being is permeated to the core by others through processes of osmosis and the uncontrollable and permissive intercourse and exchange between peoples. This, too, is my story, as in many ways it is yours. I was brought up in a colonial Malta. Independence was still 6 years away when I was born, and some of my earliest imagic memories of my childhood include portraits of a young Queen Elizabeth in my primary school and classrooms, and waving flags and genuflecting in her presence or in the presence of any member of her family who took it upon himself to have a vacation in this island in the sun, often under the guise of a diplomatic mission. I recall my father taking me to Valletta to see the changing of the guards in front of the palace in summer, and standing with him, staring in awe at these tall, white, Bombay-helmeted men marching in the midday sun. Men who somehow managed not to slouch or sweat, further evidence of their demigod status. I remember my thin, wizened grandfather in mourning when Mintoff, our then illustrious lion of a prime minister, declared that political independence could not be celebrated until the foreign naval base closed down and the Brits given their marching orders. My grandfather, like many other thousands of Maltese, felt that the island would go to the dogs without the patronage and protection of the Brits, who had ruled with grace and sagacity for 164 years, or so our school textbooks told us. These books indeed told us much about the wondrous British Empire, but precious little about our own history. And when it did, it was largely to emphasize how Christian we were, how European our roots were, and how glorious we were to resist Islam, the Turks, and the Arabs. conveniently forgetting to tell us that linguistically, culturally, genetically, and even religiously, we had absorbed our so-called adversaries right into the core of our being. I grew up, therefore, thinking of myself as white, as European, as Christian, and indeed as almost English, though not quite. You can imagine, therefore, what a shock it was for me to travel to the UK for my studies at the age of 24, when, climbing a bus in London for the first time, a young blue-eyed man spat on the floor. So, these demigods could be crass at times. Oh, my. It came as a shock to me that when I spoke in what I thought was perfect English, I was barely comprehensible to the real English, that I was not as white as I had been led to believe, and that the more I traveled north in Europe, the darker I grew, both literally and figuratively. You can perhaps also imagine the even greater shock I felt when I started my travels in our region 3 years later to discover that Tunisians and Moroccans could understand most of what I told them when I spoke Maltese, that there are areas in Djerba, Rabat, Beirut, Jaffa, Naples, Valencia, Alexandria, or Tripoli, which evoke my own childhood in villages in Malta and Gozo. Those smells, those colors, those flat-roofed houses, those women talking to each other as they hung the family clothes to dry on rooftops, the sprawl of bodies, those hot nights with windows and doors ajar at cleverly calculated angles to catch the remotest of cool breezes, those crony cats running down dark, winding yet comforting alleyways. No wonder Brodel, in his masterly portrayal of the region, exclaimed, "A native of the Mediterranean, whatever he or she might come from, would never feel out of place in any part of the sea." What started off for me as a smart aleck move to make headway in academia had increasingly become a much more profound journey that was to shape my sense of who I am, as well as my efforts to connect the sense of identity with reality around me in purposeful, reflective ways. Let me now focus the last part of my address on the lessons I have learned during this journey and try to tease out some issues that may have implications for us participants at this conference as we try to deepen our understanding of what comparative education in the Mediterranean might feel and look like. While describing these experiences, I will simultaneously be articulating elements of an agenda for Mediterranean comparative education for the future. Time is, of course, at a premium, as it always is at conferences, so I will only focus on three key issues, again the magic number three that Giovanni spoke about, assuming that several others will arise during the debates and discussions we will have during the conference and hopefully afterwards too, once we have returned to our respective homes. First, a note about the legitimacy of having the Mediterranean as a unit of analysis in comparative work. I have written at some length about this in other contexts, so I will just trace out what is at stake here. I recall that when I first started talking at gatherings of comparative education scholars about what we are trying to do in Malta and elsewhere, the initial reactions by some of the patricians of the field were not only marked by skepticism, but sometimes by outright hostility. Lutan Koy, for instance, dismissed the project, claiming that there are too many differences in the region that we call Mediterranean to make it the object of comparative analysis. His position was that it was legitimate to focus on Southern European studies or Arab regional studies or Middle East studies, but the all-embracing notion of Mediterranean could not hold water, at least in scientific terms, of course. Andreas Kazamias, erstwhile president of the Comparative and International Education Society, was initially unconvinced at, as he saw it, this attempt to put the Mediterranean Humpty Dumpty together again. He wondered openly whether this was a wild goose chase, whether the imagined Mediterranean gods were false, and whether the idea of a Mediterranean space was a figment of our imagination. Other reactions were equally barbed. One professor at Notre Dame University in the north of Lebanon felt that what we were trying to do was politically problematic, as it diverted energy and attention away from a focus on Arab issues. A highly esteemed Greek comparativist, Mari Eliou, criticized the attempt to start a journal when there was not yet an established community of scholars behind it. An Italian colleague challenge us to think through the implication of substituting a Eurocentric agenda with a megacentric one, when perhaps what we needed most was a more all-embracing vision of global citizenship, a vision which Pampanini expressed so poignantly yesterday. In many ways, of course, these critiques are not without any without some justification, and the fact that there have been few, if any, comparative education studies in the region is portentous. Most international aid agencies and development organizations, as well as research institutes, have at best a Middle East, a North Africa, or a South European studies program, even those which do claim to focus on the whole region, calling their programs MEDA or even Mediterranean, are often mostly interested in studies of Arab states, using the Mediterranean caption interchangeably, and I would say euphemistically, for Arab. The diversities between, not to mention within, countries in the Mediterranean are striking, with significant and cumulative differentials in all or most aspects of economic and social development indices, whether we are talking about demography, access to power resources, the role and place of religion, the status of individuals and their relationship to inalienable rights, and so on. Diverse colonial histories have led to the development of different educational traditions and systems, as well as to country-specific relations with metropole countries and with the power blocks present in the region, including the US and the EU. A simple, but hopefully not simplistic, answer to all this is that what we are most interested in doing in this endeavor that we are referring to as Mediterranean comparative education is not so much as the search for epistemological and positivist purity in comparing like with like, as much as finding a new standpoint, one among many others, I might add, from where to gaze at phenomena and to apprehend it in new ways by refracting it through a different lens. As I have already noted earlier with reference to my own personal journey, adopting a Mediterranean perspective can open up new opportunities for the generation of more context-specific and context-responsive frameworks that help us make sense of educational dynamics. We have discovered over the years how bringing together scholars from different parts of the Mediterranean, Israelis and Palestinians, Croats, Albanians and Serbs, Greeks and Turks, not to mention Greek and Turkish Cypriots, Syrians and Lebanese, Christians, Muslims and Jews of all denominations and shapes and sizes, these generate thematic concerns that might not have surfaced otherwise, including notions of our responsibility for future generations. We would also do well to keep firmly in mind that the fact that regions are political constructs anyway. Take the EU, for example. Who would have thought that Turkey would be seriously considered in the construction of a united Europe? Certainly not on any cultural, economic, or even geographical logic. And yet, there we are, with Europe's frontiers expanding to include countries that, when the European Coal and Steel Community was established in 1950, would not have been considered potential candidates of the new Europe by any stretch of the imagination. If Europe can think of itself as a supranational entity, despite the many diversities it embodies, there is no reason why the Mediterranean should not, assuming it wanted to. Seen historically, this Mediterranean gaze is nothing more than another faltering step in our effort to widen our associative communities from family to clan, from clan to nation, from nation to region, and to more all-embracing notions of global citizenship. In some ways, then, what we are doing here is taking up the words that Casamias uttered when he was converted to the notion that this form of comparative education was not an apostasy or heresy as much as a different way of doing science. So what, quizzed Andreas, if the gods are false, if good things are done in their name? Similarly supportive was an anonymous reviewer of a U.S. comparative education journal who suggested that what we were doing was promising not only for our region, but for other areas in the world which had a sea in Medi Terra, in the middle of land, such as the Caribbean, for instance. Bob Cowell, a UK comparativist based at the Institute of Education in London, picked up on this theme when he commented very positively on our efforts at the CSE conference, noting the promise in focusing on what he referred to as permeologies and immunologies in the rims and peripheries of this world. Such international support is obviously comforting, but nothing beats the thrill of seeing colleagues from around the region become excited by this venture, and nothing underscores the value of the project more than its ability to generate new insights into understanding and promoting sound educational practice in our region. This, I would submit, is a key agenda for us all, and for a robust future for comparative education with a Mediterranean dimension. Epistemological hurdles were the least of our worries as we set about giving shape to our Mediterranean comparative education project. Much more pressing were challenges that I will group under the term neo or post-colonial. This needs some unpacking, and a few examples will hopefully give a sense of what I'm referring to here. First, we have encountered substantial difficulties in getting South-South collaboration. Some of these difficulties arise out of the fact that our home universities rarely have the funds to facilitate research and research-related travel. Any such funds are generally made available by agencies and institutions based in the economic north, and they are often premised on notions of north-south transfer of knowledge rather than on development models that acknowledge the value of south-south collaboration. But there is a further reason to this, one that belies post-colonial mentalities, where we fail to value the indigenous knowledge and wisdom we have in our own region, preferring instead to work exclusively with universities and academics in metropole countries. There are, of course, several advantages in doing so, not least the pleasure of being taken seriously by the big shots in town. But the downside is equally obvious in terms of choice of research teams, of theoretical frameworks to make sense of data, of the usefulness of such research for the communities in which we are embedded, and so on. Post- and neocolonial issues that have an impact on our efforts to develop a Mediterranean dimension to our work arise in other ways, too. Much, for instance, has been written about the World Bank and its role in reinforcing dependency through its fundamentalist commitment to neoliberalism as the master doctrine that guarantees development. I am convinced that such critiques are fair and just. What is even more worrying from the perspective of a critical comparativist is the fact that education in our region is increasingly being colonized by World Bank agendas, particularly now that sector-wide approaches are commonplace. Swaps may mean well in getting all education sectors, including international aid and development agencies, around a table in order to ensure better coordination and more efficient use of funds. I have been around several of these tables as an observer, and very often these are World Bank tables in World Bank offices chaired by World Bank staff. I have seen UN agencies, including UNICEF and UNESCO, whom traditionally I have looked up to for the occupation of the moral high ground, being drawn into the ideological terrain as defined by the World Bank. Much of the goings-on at these swap meetings are motivated by good intentions, I'm sure, and also by a principled commitment to educational development. But it is worrying that underneath it all is an increasingly unquestioned slide into a utilitarian one-dimensional view of education as defined and determined by the North in terms of what should be prioritized, who and should implement it, and what outcomes should be expected to determine success. Anything that does not measure up to this referent is consequently defined in deficit terms, further reinforcing dependency. It bears underlining the point that the European Union's activities are not outside this critique. While some of its interventions in the region are to be lauded, and I have in mind the recently established Anna Lindh Foundation for Dialogue Between Cultures in Alexandria, others are much less so. Take the Euro-Mediterranean Partnership, for instance. The so-called Barcelona protest, which was launched in 1995 in order to establish a wide framework for political, economic, and social relations between the member states of the EU and partners of the Southern Mediterranean, brazenly suggests that higher education institutions should be set up and developed in the MEDA region with EU member states' support in order to safeguard EU economic interests, especially in relation to the goal of offsetting competition from the US. More recently, the EU borrowed a feather from the cap of the American Fulbright program, establishing an Erasmus Mundus program in order to ensure that the brightest and the best from developing countries in the world studied and stayed on in the EU rather than in the US. There seems to have been little concern here about the fact that what represents a brain gain for the EU in its effort to reach the Lisbon objective to become the most competitive and dynamic knowledge-based economy in the world by 2010, in fact, represents a brain drain from countries who can ill afford this luxury. Our efforts to develop a Mediterranean dimension in our comparative work would therefore, in my view, require us to recognize that what some of the drivers behind development aid are, and to establish our own agendas in ways that are more responsive to our needs and which benefit our priorities. Mediterranean comparative education should also be recognizable by its active search for alternative forms of educational practice, ones that contest the reductionist vision of schooling in terms of skills and competencies that drives so much of what passes as education in the world today. The development of a Mediterranean dimension in comparative education has a third challenge to face, one that I'm here referring to as dislocated provincialism, an oxymoron, of course, but one which serves to vehicle what I wish to say. By its very nature, comparative education requires scholars to rise above the particular to consider this in relation to broader principles, as well as in relation to broader geographical and epistemological vistas. Indeed, one of the benefits that is usually attributed to comparative education is that it provides a body of descriptive and explanatory data which allows us to see various practices and procedures in a very wide context that helps to throw light upon them. Now, a lot of what passes as educational scholarship in our region tends to be precisely the opposite. I am here reflecting in particular on the literally scores of submissions that reach the editorial board of our journal, and that we have to reject. Needless to say, there are many excellent to good pieces that we receive and publish, and that also appear in other, often more prominent journals internationally. On the basis of what reaches us, and the delight of conversations I have had with Arab, Turkish, and other scholars from the Mediterranean countries whose languages I do not speak, and who could comment on papers that appear in their own countries' journals, I have drawn a number of conclusions which, if correct, signal a serious obstacle to development of comparative education in our region. I am here referring to the fact that many papers in education are narrow and provincial in scope. They typically focus on a very specific issue and restrict their purview to a very limited and particular context. My problem with these kinds of papers is not the narrow focus in and of itself. After all, as Leopold Sedar Senghor once pointed out, by living the particular to the full, we reach the dawn of the universal. It is rather that such studies remain narrowly provincial, failing to place the specific context in a broader national or regional one, or to analyze how national, political, cultural, or economic dynamics have an impact on the phenomena that are being described. Hence the term dislocated provincialism that I am using here. At the end of the day, one is forgiven for concluding that what is being described could very well have taken place in Australia or the Azores, as no contextual clues are given, nor is there any insight into how specificity of place shapes educational phenomena and practices in particular ways. Such lack of embeddedness appears in other ways too. Literature reviews draw almost exclusively on what is reported in other generally Western and high-income countries. The assumption is made that what was discovered in those countries applies unproblematically to the author's own. It is not surprising, therefore, that theoretical and explanatory frameworks, when they appear, are almost without exception also drawn from metropole countries, with little attempt to acknowledge the specificities of country and region, such as, for instance, the preponderance of informal labor markets and the impact this has on motivation to engage with formal learning, the negative returns to schooling, the importance of wasta and family influence in getting employment, the particular relationship between religious elites and leaders in the state apparatus, and how this impacts on education in such areas as curriculum development, or the way private tutoring reproduces elites. Insensitivity to context is also often evident when it comes to making recommendations about ways forward, such as when teacher development models are unproblematically borrowed from the US, UK, or the US, or France, with little, if any, attention given to the fact that most teachers in our region are underpaid, have to hold down a second and third job after school hours in order to make ends meet. The methodological tools that are employed also tend to be narrowly quantitative in scope, with papers typically rehearsing the tired mantra that starts off with purpose of study, followed by definition of the problem and definition of terms, moving on to a description of the methodology, with subsections on sampling and the choice of instruments used to measure the phenomenon in question. When we come to the substance of the paper, what we get is often a discussion of results section, which generally includes the presentations of several often impeccably designed statistical tables. However, in far too many instances, the reaction of reviewers to such attempts are that the mountain has labored only to give birth to a mouse. Or to quote the advice given by an exasperated and perhaps somewhat cheeky referee, what is not worth measuring is not worth measuring well. There are, of course, many possible reasons for these shortcomings, though we need to be careful and nuanced in our approach to avoid the temptation of unproblematically adopting the reference and measuring sticks of metropole universities. Certainly, the almost total dependence of academics on the state for their livelihood renders them vulnerable, as the Finland-based Moroccan sociologist Sabur states in his discussion of academics in the Arab world. It is a bit like sending out the matador to face the bull without his muleta. The limited intellectual freedom in some of the region's universities, together with not unfounded fears of reprisals, can act as a powerful deterrent to sociologically imaginative and politically engaged research that speaks to context in very specific ways. The fact remains, however, that comparative education in our region can only thrive if, to sustain the image, we do take the bull by the horns and develop a community of inquiry where we support each other's efforts to engage the world as it is, to imagine a world as it could and should be. In conclusion, what I have attempted to do in this keynote address is to share with you my personal and professional journey in developing a Mediterranean dimension in comparative education. I have highlighted the way that such a journey has opened the road for cultural dialogue for me, a dialogue that has both intrapersonal and interpersonal dimensions, leading to self-discovery and to the discovery of the other in this self. I have also highlighted the practical steps that we have put into place at the University of Malta in an effort to take on what, for many, is a quixotic and idealistic desire to connect education researchers in this diverse, often divided region of ours. Finally, I have pointed out to three main obstacles that we still need to overcome if we are to make headway in the future, namely, 1, the lack of confidence in the legitimacy of our project, 2, the neoliberal and neocolonial influence on the definition of what counts as education, and 3, the dislocated provincialism that pervades much of our educational scholarship. In all three cases, the antidote seems to me to be the same: the development of a community of scholars that collaborates across South, South, and South-North axes in order to develop the confidence, strength, and drive to make a positive difference to education in our region. It is my hope that this conference, under the auspices of the Mediterranean Society of Comparative Education, takes us one step further in this direction by providing us with an eminent opportunity for dialogical co-investigation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ronald. I just have a quick question about the contribution of the journal that you have started to elaborate in relation to the broader Mediterranean agenda that you have outlined regarding comparative education. I wonder whether you could say a little bit more about, for example, the role the journal can or could take in terms of encouraging this methodological diversity that you have been referring to at the end. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. If I understand the question correctly, it's the role that the journal can play in encouraging this both methodological and epistemological diversity, but also, I suppose, in encouraging this community of scholars that are searching for context-sensitive studies, research, and reactions to educational dynamics in the region. Well, you know, it's a journal. I don't know how many of you have actually managed a journal. It's really a labor of love and a labor of frustration. I've been at it for 12 years. It's cottage industry. That is, you can imagine me not only getting the articles and spreading them around for refereeing purposes, but also placing the damn thing in the envelopes and putting the stamp on them. So it's really tiring and tiresome work. But it is encouraging to see that there is an increasing interest and that we have a very good network of reviewers who encourage those who submit papers to think differently, to expand their insights, to we refer them to studies that have potentially value for them. So the journal, in a sense, is the thread that links many of us in the region, and it's also a way of ensuring knowledge transfer south-south, both in terms of people located in southern universities and Mediterranean universities, but also those who, like Andre, are part of the diaspora of the Mediterranean. There's so much of that. So it's a space which encourages this kind of co-constructed discourse around comparative education, what education is about, the politics of education. So I see it has a very valuable role. What we need to do is be a bit more smart and strategic in making sure that it reaches as many universities as possible. And that's something that could happen, for example, although we are discussing this, if MESHE becomes stronger by having people like you joining, and that the journal becomes also a journal that is associated closely with MESHE. That is something that we are looking into.
Well, thank you, Ronald, for a really extremely rich and very appreciated talk. I want to just pick up a bit on the point you were making about the critique about this consolidated sort of international program for education in the Mediterranean and in the world. And you mentioned the World Bank and UNICEF and how there's this kind of consolidated neoliberal ideal or reform push for education. And then you said something like, we have to be sure that it's not a matter of their agenda, but we have to have our agenda too. And I wonder how we distinguish anymore between ours and theirs when there's so much consolidation of this kind of, we can call it neoliberal agenda for educational reform. And what do we mean anymore? There's no longer this clear colonize, but this whole international consolidation for a certain type of reform.
I don't have magic answers to this very important question, a very challenging question. But I do have a gut feeling that from what I've seen in the region, the best way to ensure that we do have a counter discourse is to be engaged not just in universities but in communities. Somehow, what I have seen some very exciting academics, some very exciting thinking, some people who have developed a counter discourse who remain very close to communities. And somehow, that closeness, that awareness of need, that awareness, that dynamic that happens at that level generates powerful insights which depart from, or which at least contest, the neoliberal fundamentalist doctrines that permeate our very existence. I mean, Habermas talks about how technocratic rationality has colonized our life world, and I think he is right in saying so. But it's also true that in communities, in these vibrant communities, one can sense that there are issues there, that there are possibilities of linking real everyday life experiences with, you know, theoretical insights that can produce a counter discourse. This is my gut feeling. I mean, I don't know if this makes sense to people who are present. Thank you very much.